Give us the teaching of Marcos Chiave. Kebra Negas means glory of kings. Give Ayanai Selassie and keep the images of lies for yourself. People without a vision perish like suicide. You tell me it's not about color, still you refuse to take the picture off the wall. All you do is trick the brothers and keep them confused. They don't know who to call on in this spiritual war. Now tell me of a paradise in the sky, but that's a lie. And now tell me I was born in sin and shaped in iniquity, and love created I. Look how many prophets tried to open our eyes. You can't fool me.
Born in the Bronx, raised in Jamaica. That's Tarus Riley, son of the well-known reggae artist Jimmy Riley, with the tune Marcus Garvey. It's from Tarus's 2012 album, Mikustic. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and a program I hope will move you into action today. Our guest is Dr. Julius Garvey, son of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey. And he's here to talk about a years-long effort to clear his father's name and reputation by way of a presidential pardon. The founder and driving force behind the first global black nationalist movement, the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League, that's for short, the UNIACL, in 1923 was convicted in a rigged federal trial of wire fraud. Garvey's conviction served as the basis for his deportation back to Jamaica and eventually served as the basis to destroy the UNIACL. Dr. Julius Garvey and several noteworthy organizations and individuals in recent years have been pressing for a presidential pardon of the revered leader by President Barack Obama, but we're here to discuss whether there are any encouraging signs in this regard. Dr. Julius Garvey is a thoracic and cardiac surgeon, a phlebologist, a certified wound care specialist, and founder and director of the Garvey Vascular Specialists, a medical office operating in Nassau and Queens counties since 1974. He's the son, as I said, of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, the pioneer of global black nationalism. And it is great to have you with us today, Dr. Garvey.
Thanks, you three, for having me. It's good to be with you.
Yes, it's been quite a while.
And a long time.
It's a joy to have you with us.
Your voice still sounds the same, even though I haven't seen you for a long time.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Well, the most recent effort was made on the occasion of your father's 129th birthday, in which you tried to drive home the point that this is unfinished business. How do you think it went?
I think it went very well, in some sense. It was picked up by C-SPAN, and that gave it a very, very broad coverage, apart from the reporters, et cetera, that were present. So we've gotten significant feedback from different organizations, different people, and that is continuing on a daily basis in terms of interviews and people signing on to the petition. So we're very pleased with that. That basically was an announcement of a petition that, you know, has been sent to the U.S. Department of Justice, the Pardon Attorney's Office, as well as to the White House Counsel, to the attention of the President. So it's the petition was formed and formulated and went through meticulously by a Washington-based firm, Akin Gump Strauss Howard, who are well known. So the legal aspect of it is taken care of. Now we need to mobilize, you might say, public opinion to let the president know and to allow the president to move in the right direction to correct an injustice that has lasted for almost 100 years.
Could you give us a background, because many people may not be as familiar with Marcus Mosiah Garvey and his significance in the scheme of things relating to the formation of a global black consciousness, and out of that, global black political nationalist movements that ended up, of course, achieving independence in many parts, but mostly reconstituting the political consciousness?
Well, I think, you Tracy have stated it very well. You know, a lot of people, try to simplify Marcus Garvey and say, it's the Black Africa movement, or some people will say, it's a civil rights movement here in the United States, or some people say, well, he formed the first political party in Jamaica or whatever. But, you know, this is as a result, really, of the power structure trying to debase his ideology and his organizational effort in trying to uplift African people worldwide, because this was his mission. He had traveled the world, between 1910 and 1914 when he got back to Jamaica. And he saw the conditions of African people all over the world. And if we think of 1914, I mean, this was in the middle of colonialism. Colonialism really started at the Berlin Conference, something like 1885. Marcus Garvey was born in 1887. So he was born, you know, as a colonial person in the heart, so to speak, of the British Empire, with all that meant in terms of the destruction of African history, African culture, and of course, it had been preceded by slavery, which disconnected us from even our sense of our own humanity, because we were treated as animals and commodities that could be bought and sold, and with the utmost of brutality. And of course, it has continued since then, all the way down now to Black Lives Matter, where they're still shooting us down on the streets in the United States of America in major and minor cities. So this was the condition that Marcus Garvey saw, and it came to him as his destiny. He said that he then would have to formulate the black man's government, and he then would have to reform, and he used the term redeem, Africa, meaning redemption of African civilization and African human beings, to rehumanize us as we had been dehumanized by what has been considered European civilization. And I'm not sure how you can call it civilization when you dehumanize people, because civilization should be about, humanizing people within society. So this was his lifelong passion, and this was what he created the organization for. And it received enormous welcome from African people all over, because, as I mentioned, we had been dehumanized, and we had been stooping over, so to speak, under the system that marginalized us in every way and created us as dependents of the people who had conquered us, basically, in many areas of Africa and kidnapped us and continued to hold us in subservience. So this then presented itself as a major dagger, so to speak, pointed at the heart of the colonizers and the racist and white supremacists here in the United States and the apartheid in South Africa and so on. So it stimulated all of these movements, the civil rights movements here, the independence movements in the Caribbean, the independence and national movements in all parts of Africa. I mean, all the way from Kenya, basically Jomo Kenyatta called himself a Gaviite, so did Kwame Nkrumah. The ANC in South Africa was birthed out of the Garvey movement. The same thing in Namibia. SWAPO was birthed out of the Garvey movement, etc. And Ezekiwe in Nigeria. So this was really the beginning of black consciousness, as you say. And Steve Biko, of course, also was a disciple of that. And as a matter of fact, I was invited by the Steve Biko Society and the Robert Sobukwe Foundation to give the lecture in South Africa. And I visited Steve Biko's gravesite. As you know, he was beaten to death by the apartheid people for his role in trying to advance black consciousness, which is simply human consciousness in black people. So, you know, again, the struggle continues, but that was his mission. And these were the types of people that he stimulated. And, of course, now we have, you know, independent nations all over, but we have not still achieved that freedom that allows us to chart our own course and tell our own story.
Well, it goes to the heart of the matter that a movement this powerful that could galvanize people all over the world under a common realization and a common purpose, a common vision, naturally was seen as a threat, a major threat, and not just in the United States, but you said to white supremacy all over the world. So yeah. Garvey had to be, quote, dealt with, unquote. And in the United States, where he really crystallized this movement, where he had millions of people literally galvanized under this black consciousness, not white hatred, and that's the other part that people seem to think, that your black consciousness implies that you hate other people. No, you don't. You're retrieving the missing pages of your history and your culture, and yes. You're coming to a whole different realization of how you really have been a factor for millennia all throughout the world. How did Garvey end up, I should say, how did the system end up having Garvey in their clutches and using the legal system as the way to get him out of the picture?
Well, you know, basically, it was the aim of the so-called Justice Department under J. Edgar Hoover to destroy Garvey way back as far as 1919. There's an internal memo that has surfaced where J. Edgar Hoover says that, you know, there's a Negro agitator up in Harlem, and, you know, we don't want any black liberators. We've got to get him. And so, you know, he infiltrated the organization and so on, and they formulated these charges. And, you know, of course, also there was an attempt on his life prior to this, around this time, I should say. I think it was also in 1919. Somebody came in and shot several shots at him. I think one of which grazed his head, and I think one also grazed his leg, but they caught the fellow. Interestingly enough, the police took him to jail, but supposedly he committed suicide in jail that same night, which is very, very interesting. Why would he commit suicide in jail? You know, but I think the story is that he said he was going to spill the beans on those who had put him up to shoot Garvey and kill Garvey. Anyway, that was part of that whole business of getting rid of him. It was, how should I say, instigating both violence as well as a judicial approach, meaning to utilize the judicial system to find some way to get him. And there are continued memos that saying, gee, you know, he's doing this Black Star Line thing. Let's see if we can't find a way to get him with this. So, you know, that was the whole background of it. J. Edgar Hoover, infiltration of the movement, the perjury of witnesses, the lack of evidence, all of that, you know, was present in this trial, which was really a fiasco. But it was a well-orchestrated fiasco under the guise of justice and under the guise that they were somehow protecting Black people from Marcus Garvey, when not one single member of the organization or otherwise protested against Marcus Garvey, even though they canvassed thousands of the members, you know, trying to get somebody to say that, you know, Marcus Garvey was doing wrong. But, you know, nobody took that bait. But, of course, they brought their own stooge who couldn't even identify where he worked in terms of the organization, who his boss was, although he was supposed to pick up a paycheck every week, but he couldn't identify where he picked up the paycheck. I mean, you know, he was coached by the prosecuting attorney who was a perjurer and coached a perjurer. I mean, it was a total hoax, but it was enough to be able to convince a jury, not of his peers, but of course of white people with the surrounding hysteria that, you know, Marcus Garvey was somehow anti-white, and so he was convicted and then jailed over time when his appeal failed as well.
Why is it important to you or to history that Marcus Garvey, be pardoned? And what value is it to be pardoned anyway, if in the minds of the world he was he was illegally convicted.
I understand you, Latrice. Latrice, let me just say this, that, you know, we're not looking for a pardon. We're using the position of a pardon because we have gone the other route, meaning that, you know, we have participated with Congressman John Conyers in terms of the 1987. This was brought up before the House Judiciary Committee. And that did not succeed. Also, the exoneration was brought up by Congressman Rangel with several House resolutions from 2004 onwards. So this is a sort of not necessarily last ditch, but this is one method now to utilize this pardon process. But however, what we expect in terms of the pardon, because what we have presented is the evidence in greater detail than what I've just said to you, that the whole trial was a hoax and that there was no crime and therefore no guilt. And we would expect that, quotes, the posthumous pardon process and statement by the president would say that there was no crime, because that's the evidence that's presented to him. Now, you might add, you said, why is it important? It's important from the point of history and legacy. Because, you know, Marcus Garvey's ideology and what he proposed in terms of, as you would call it, Black consciousness or African consciousness, or Africans being conscious of their humanity and their history, which is the oldest in the world, and preceded European history, you know, by probably 100,000 years, if we can believe the anthropologists, you know. The Ice Age didn't end in Europe until about 10,000 years ago, whereas, even more recent than that, but the first Europeans, anyway, I think were found about 10,000 years ago that could be called Europeans. So that we have preceded them in civilization, in history, and in culture. And recognizing that, it presents a challenge to this concept of white supremacy, and that somehow civilization started with Greece, et cetera, et cetera. And the Europeans now have given this wonderful civilized democracy, et cetera, to the world. inculcating it in all of these more primitive areas and primitive peoples. This is a lie of history itself, because there's no such truth to it. The Greeks learned from the Africans. I mean, it's all there from Herodotus and so many others of the historians of the time. You see, but this story was transformed from the 18th century onward, and even a little bit earlier, in order to justify the enslavement of a people, and eventually, the conquest of the whole world by Europeans. I mean, the savagery with which this was done, it was not a victory of ideas or reason or rationality. I shouldn't even say rationality, but it certainly was not a conquest of ideas. It was a conquest by violence, pure and simple, because the Native Americans had a great civilization in terms of their own humanity, and so did Africans who preceded them in civilization, preceded in society, knowing how to live together as people. And I think one of the things that the Europeans have shown us is that they don't know how to live together as people, that they've killed each other prolifically over the years, including the Civil War here in the United States, and they have continued to kill large numbers of people all over the world. So they're not a people of peace. They're not a people who create a social order of peace and contentment around people. And they do not put human beings first, which is an African perspective, so that we have preceded them in that. I think then coming back to your point, Utrus, is that Marcus Garvey is based on this African concept of human beings coming first, which, as you know, nowadays people are calling it Ubuntu, which is, again, an old African concept, because you are, I am, and because I am, we are. We're all in this together. We're all brothers and sisters. And this is part of the preamble of the UNIA Constitution, etc., the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God. It doesn't exclude anybody, you see, and that has to be the basis of civilization, because we all have to live together. And this is even more urgent at the present time. But people still see that as a danger, because they want to maintain hegemony. When in a world that is well-ordered, there needs to be equity and not hegemony. And basically, we need all to be understood to be equal to each other, which is basic in our DNA, etc., and our scientists have shown us that there's just one race. But unfortunately, we still have the ideology of white supremacy that has been systematized in so many of the systems of government, education, law, etc., etc., and used against us as African people.
The system of white supremacy seems to be systematized even in the White House. You have the so-called first African-American president who goes to Jamaica to honor the heroes and heroines of Jamaica. Mm-hmm. And one would have expected that the quintessential hero, apart from Nanny, would have been someone who would have come to his attention by way of paying homage, and he didn't.
Yes, I think that
was a very big slap in the face. And then subsequent efforts to basically say, look, you're one of us. This is something you know to be extremely important. The Caribbean is extremely important. The reason we have Caribbean nations at this point largely has to do with Marcus Garvey. And you were able to go down there. You ignored the fact you were in his homeland. You ignored the fact other entreaties have been made here in the United States, where there is a significant Caribbean population and a significant African-American population affected, the Nation of Islam, other groups, pick any civil rights group and you can trace its origins and its philosophy to Marcus Garvey. But you're not getting good signals from the White House. Why do you think that is?
you know, anything I say would be speculation. But I think that any president is, you might say, a prisoner of the office, and is not free to act necessarily on his own conscience or his own intellectual strivings. He has to conform to what is expected of the President of the United States and the President of the so-called greatest country in the world, certainly the strongest and the richest, so that when one functions outside of those prescriptions, there are consequences. And, you know, I don't think we need to go deeper into that. I think we do know that President Kennedy was assassinated. And I'm not sure that we know all the reasons why he was assassinated. I certainly don't think it was just by chance.
Well, I do refer to the fact that on his last day as president, President Bill Clinton issued 140 pardons, many of them having to do with friends who committed grievous wrongs and deserved to be in jail. And for some reason, because they made large donations to his foundation and to his campaigns and so forth, got pardoned, including his own brother. What accounts? Do you see any hesitancy, or do you see a kind of what should I say?
Well, you, Teresa, I think that's why I'm somewhat hopeful. You know, because this is the window now, and clearly, you know, President Obama has underutilized that executive privilege, and it's been brought to public attention very recently in the last week or two. And he has this window of opportunity, and he's done a lot of commutation of sentences of people like drug addicts, etc. He's way behind other presidents in terms of utilizing the pardon process. So, you know, we have the legal document there. I mean, we've done all the, you know, dotting of the I's and crossing of the T's. It's there, and we're trying to raise, you know, public awareness and public attention so that then is also fed into the White House and would encourage him to then, you know, make that decisive executive step. So we're very hopeful because of those reasons.
So how do people bolster this effort? What can they do?
Well, like what you're doing, you, Therese, meaning that, you know, allowing the word to get out there, you know, by radio, by TV, by print, and we're now, you know, we've mailed out things to different people, but we're now setting up the website so that we'll be able to have an online petition. And I'll get back to you as soon as that is set up. It may be available today, I'm not sure, but certainly in another day or so, our online ability to go to whitehouse.gov and support our petition for the posthumous pardon of Marcus Garvey. So that's definitely in the works, and we need to get public opinion behind the process.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I know you're under the crunch of time. You have patients waiting for you, and we just barged in on your life. So thank you so much for being with us today.
They're waiting patiently.
Oh, that's very good fun. We will certainly keep in touch, and we will follow this quest to redeem the name of Marcus Mosiah Garvey. We'll take this break and come back, and I'll say all the things that Dr. Garvey was hesitant to say right after this.
Look how they're treating us.
new millennium slavery, hiding the chains and still beating us daily. Now it mentally poisoned to fight with black skin. And bleaching at the inting, far out and far in. Sin, you tell me it's not about color, still you refuse. Take the picture out your books. I know that's not how he looks. Kush, all you do is trick the brothers and keep them confused. They don't know who to call on in this heretical war. Don't tell me of a paradise in the sky, then that's a lie. And not tell me I was born in sin and shaped in iniquity when love created I. Look how many prophets tried to open our eyes.
On PRN.FM, I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're talking about Marcus Mazar Garvey today and yet another effort to return to him his reputation and his honor, which was taken away from him in a rigged federal trial. And the purpose was really clear. By the time this trial came about, at the behest of an extremely ambitious young man named J. Edgar Hoover, there was only one point, and that was to destroy anything that approximated a movement, a political movement that would automatically be seen as a threat to the state, to American values, to everything white, and white was the most important thing. Marcus Garvey, I just want to point out here, and it's important for you to do some reading about Marcus Mazar Garvey. He was a young man in his 30s. He was really merely in his 30s when he began this work of seeing the logic of bringing all these African peoples, wherever they were in the world, scattered by the colonial powers, then up to their eyeballs in this thing called slavery, making tons and tons of money off of the free labor. But we talk about the labor of slaves. Those are the people who survived. We very seldom talk about those who did not survive the transatlantic crossing. And we're told in excess of 200 million. My friend, the late Dr. Jan Carew, tells us about what happened in this hemisphere under colonial powers, the genocidal impact of their quest to rule and dominate the world. In the United States, of course, we had the unique formulation of domination by this made-up idea of racial superiority and the flip side of the coin of racial inferiority. They perfected it. So much so that Adolf Hitler adopted it. Many countries abroad seeking to annihilate the undesirables, the Roma, for example, who, along with Jews, were just wiped out. So this was a country that perfected this so-called science. And it is a science. White supremacy, racism is a science. We need to understand that. Why do I call it a science? This is not just the expression of bad manners. Racism is not just individual choice. It's a scientific application that yields exactly the same result no matter where the formula is applied. That makes it scientific. Racism is the science of domination through this method. But Marcus Garvey was merely in his 30s. I want to emphasize that because so many people today believe that they come to fruition, they come into their fullness someplace in their 50s and 60s when they're getting ready to check out. No, he was at this. He was at this and applied himself to this and saw the logic of it to bring back together in some kind of a cohesive form to harness all that power, all that wealth that was there. I recently looked at a map of Harlem going back to the 1920s. And on that map, I saw locations owned and operated by the UNIA. It was amazing. Dry cleaners stores, grocery stores, barber shops, beauty parlors, printing presses, all kinds of businesses that people use every day. And the map shows where they were located so that you can literally have all of your needs met, and you are spending money in your community, you're supporting community businesses, and this was a base for economic development, which was remarkable. And you imagine how powerful this model is when replicated, not just all over the United States, but all over the world. No wonder he was targeted. No wonder this bogus trial, no wonder the infiltration of his organization. It happens. And Garvey dies, in his mind, not nearly fulfilling his grand vision and the grand mission. But I say he certainly did. Even the flags of many African countries and many Caribbean countries reflect a consciousness of Garveyism. Huge movements in the United States, for the first time, people were awakened to the inherent power and how best to harness it so that they can achieve some degree of parity in a system that was absolutely hell-bent on destroying them. So this brings me to Barack Obama. All these hopes and dreams and aspirations and so forth, people think, well, you know, the first black president, that is an accomplishment. And believe me, I do not minimize the historicity of it. It's a historic milestone. But as I said, I made it clear, I did not vote for Barack Obama. Either time, whether 2008 or 2012, I did not vote for Barack Obama. Because he betrayed early, he betrayed himself. And he did so in a manner that absolutely, I mean, it killed the spirit of Garvey. When he offered up on the altar of political expediency his own spiritual advisor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, white America said, you must disown him, you must condemn him, you must separate yourself from him, because we deem him to be unsuitable. There was nothing in that man's history that said he was an unsuitable person, and particularly an unsuitable spiritual leader in his community in Chicago. There was nothing that said that. And when this president refused to do the right thing then, to stand on principle, but instead became an active agent in the destruction of a person, I said, this is not a good man. You got to watch him. He will not get my support. If you could do that, there's nothing else that you won't do if the price is right. People ask, well, why didn't you? I mean, how could you? Lots of my friends couldn't understand it. Why would you not vote? This is a great time. You got to vote for the guy. No. No. Because I'm concerned that at this time, the history you ought to make is standing on principle. Garvey stood on principle. He paid with his life for it. He sacrificed everything in behalf of people, his people. And the record shows he didn't compromise. He didn't sell out. He didn't distance himself. He didn't believe himself to be better than any other people. And he did not play those bourgeois, black bourgeois games of being light and bright. He was very clear. And you know why I like this word clarity. He had clarity. So President Obama goes down to Jamaica, supposedly to participate in national celebrations of their heroes. Okay, this was, I believe, in April of last year. And there was a big fuss made about President Obama. Except it was so clear. You're the first African-American president. You got, let me make the case, all right? Barack Obama, as the first black president of the United States, is a direct beneficiary of the work of Marcus Garvey. See, that's how I see it. And that's how I think he ought to see it. You want to talk about people on whose shoulders you stand? He stands on Garvey's shoulders. Not the Democratic Party's, but Garvey's. He goes down to Jamaica, and it was so glaringly insulting. Garvey is like so revered in Jamaica, as he ought to be. He's a son of the soil. You have nothing to say about Garvey, and you do not dare. He did not dare raise his name. He ignored him completely, which is now, it goes beyond having this personal problem called spinelessness. And now you insult the entire country by saying, hey, I'm just here to have some fun, some ackee and saltfish, and I'll be out of here. By this evening, I'll be gone. The real reason that Barack Obama went to Jamaica, and by the way, that was his first time going, the real reason he went was so clear. China has been all over the Caribbean, doing all kinds of things, including taking up as many of its resources as it possibly could put its hands on. China's all over the place in the Caribbean. building things, giving governments all kinds of incentives to keep them as partners for a long time. That is the reason that Barack Obama showed up, just to say, hey, listen, you know, we're your friends. But it came at the expense of insulting a nation by refusing to recognize its unquestioned hero, Marcus Garvey. You go to Africa, where you can look at all the African flags. You see the inferences of the red, black, and green incorporated into their flags. Recognition of Garvey. Then he comes back here, and this is, you know, people want him to move affirmatively, and he's talking all the legal stuff about, well, you know, there's a requirement to grant a pardon. You have to be alive still, and we don't know that we can do this as a presidential pardon. Presidential pardons are for other all these kinds of silly, nonsensical excuses for the fact that he doesn't have the guts to do it. It's a very simple thing, except it requires a great deal of guts. And what it says is that this president is not about doing anything that jeopardizes his relationship with the white supremacist authority in this country. Even something we would say is small, maybe, but it isn't. To the people, millions of people around the world, this is not a small thing. Bill Clinton, as I said, on his last day before he got out, he says, you know what? I'm issuing, today is National Pardons Day. Who do I know who could use a pardon? All kinds of people got pardons who were his friends, who were absolute criminals. They got pardons. Lots and lots of pardons. On his last day, he said, before I get out of here, I'm going to give people pardons whether they need them or qualify for them or not. President Obama has to prove that he is above. He is antiseptically clean. And we know he's not, because he's supporting Hillary Clinton. You can't be clean and support Hillary Clinton. It just doesn't go together. But there is another level going on here, and it has to do with the parallel narrative. The parallel narrative here, it is, on the one level, it is about pardoning or exonerating, which is what the word I prefer to use, to exonerate Marcus Garvey, because Marcus Garvey, in the end, was the victim of a super corrupt, racist, white supremacist system. That, too, is the president's responsibility to address and correct. And he can do that even symbolically by exonerating Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey, a world leader, was nonetheless treated like any other black man in this country. A rigged trial, a bogus trial, targeted for political assassination, and then deported to live as if he was barely clinging to life. And then doing everything possible after that to quash his memory, to quash his name, to quash this movement. And this is why I believe when people make these kinds of mistakes, one, they're not deliberate. They're not accidental. They're deliberate mistakes. And when they make these deliberate kinds of mistakes, you must deliberately punish them and the entire system that set them up to do these nefarious things, i.e. the Democratic Party. If people decided to be really serious about this, you say, no pardon, no vote. I am not going to vote because you're not for doing the right thing by Marcus Garvey, who I respect and whose work is the reason that I'm enjoying some modicum of a decent life today. See, that's how you operate. That's how I think politics ought to work. And if you support Hillary Clinton, no matter who you support, we are against them too. On the memory and the reputation and the work of Marcus Garvey, in his name, we will punish you. That's how you do politics. I know for the purposes of, you know, social order and all of that, people have to submit, you know, entreaties and submit papers, and there's a process. But the flip side of the coin is that the people have work to do as well. And the work that they can do is say, this is what we want. We don't get it. Neither do you. You're not going to get it. Our job is to back up the demand with our own demand and action. If Marcus Garvey is not exonerated, you could forget it, Democratic Party. We don't care what you think. That's how you flex your political muscles. I mean, you look at this map, I'm telling you, it will jar you to see this hub, this economic engine that was built by the Garvey movement in Harlem when racism was at its extreme. And you had all these thriving businesses employing their own people, manufacturing their own goods, serving their own needs. And you see block after block, you see the buildings identified as to where these businesses are. And today, supposedly, even after all this progress, Harlem is nothing, nothing like it was when Garvey was active in the 1920s. That's a story to tell. This wasn't just talk. This was action and the realization of action that was a symbol and a fact, a real fact of true political power. You don't have people like that. You have people running around asking, what next should they do? How next could I please you? Oh, you want me to stomp on Jeremiah Wright and destroy this man who has done nothing? Oh, sure, I'll do that. Don't forget, these are the lessons we have learned as well, not only about the yeoman efforts made by the Garveys of the world, and we are lucky to have had them. It is our job, it is our duty to protect their reputation and their work. It is our job to be good stewards of their work. This silly president running around asking permission to do things, when you had all these people backing you, believing in your mantra about hope, the audacity of hope. You have neither audacity and we ain't got no hope. But what we do have is resolve, and we should take that seriously. This is not a mamby-pamby symbolic thing about getting Marcus Garvey's name cleared. Marcus Garvey's name has been cleared many, many decades ago by the people who understood what this was. What we have to do is to serve notice that we have not forgotten. That's our job. Thanks so much for joining me today. I appreciate it. And I hope you come back tomorrow. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you think about the program. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. And I'll keep you abreast of this effort to restore Marcus Garvey's reputation that was deliberately destroyed by the United States government. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Look how many prophets tried to open our eyes. Can't fool me. So now tell me of a paradise in the sky. Well, that's a lie. And now tell me I was born in sin and shaped in iniquity when Jah created I. Look how many prophets tried. Look how many prophets tried.